What can past climate change tell us about the present? Let's talk with a deep time specialist. Dr. Robert Spicer is a professor at the Open University in the United Kingdom, and he works with CEPSAR, the Center for Earth, Planetary Space and Astronomical Research. He's also been a key consultant to several high-profile BBC specials on climate change. Professor Spicer, at the recent presentation by Sir James Lovelock to the Royal Society, you described yourself as someone working with deep time and previous greenhouse worlds. Can you tell us just a little bit about those previous hot states? What was it like?
Well, for about 80% of the last 500 million years, the global mean surface temperature of the Earth has been warmer than it is now. So that means we are living in a somewhat cool period in Earth history. Now, what that means is that there is a huge amount of information in the rock record, fossils, sediments, isotopes, that tells us how the world works when it's warmer than it is now, a situation where we may well be returning to. So by looking at the sediments and rocks, fossils, this kind of thing, we can understand a lot more about how the world works and understand those processes that at the moment are rather difficult for us to see in the world around us. So let's take ourselves back to the time of the dinosaurs, for example. Let's go back around about 70 to 100 million years ago. Now, this is a world in which there are no ice caps to speak of. There may have been a small one at elevation in Antarctica, but the northern hemisphere and the Arctic in particular was essentially ice-free. Now, instead of having the ice flows and the rather cold situation that we have now, what we had were extremely lush forests, growing to as far north as 85 degrees north. And within these forests, we have dinosaurs running around. If you go south from there into the more temperate regions, through into the subtropics and the tropics appear to be a lot drier than they are now, with seasonal rainfall rather than year-round rainfall. So that means that in terms of the ability of the forest to sequester carbon from the atmosphere, most of the effective carbon locking up and vegetation growth was at the high latitudes near the poles. And this is the kind of situation that we're likely to return to in the not too distant future.
Well, how do we know what happened so long ago? What kind of tools do time explorers use?
Well, we can look at isotopes of oxygen. These give us some idea of temperature, but mostly these are used for marine situations. So we can look at the surface temperature of the oceans, and we can also look at the bottom temperatures of the oceans, because different organisms live in different heights in the water column, and if they bring the oxygen isotopes that are in the water into their shells, for example, and these are preserved through time, then we can tell something about the temperature profiles. But as I said, these are mostly marine. We can do it on land, but it's not quite so straightforward because we have the effect of rain and various other things. We can also look at the distribution of sediments. So, for example, if we find coal, then we know that it must have been warm enough for plant growth to occur and wet enough not only to provide the plants with water, but also to preserve the carbon in those plants. In other words, you need to build up large bodies of peat and this kind of thing. If we look at bauxites or laterites, these are minerals and sediments that form under warm and wet conditions. There are a variety of clay minerals that require a certain combination of warmth and wetness to form. And at the other end of the extreme, we can look at things like evaporites, salt beds. Now, where these form is where there is an extremely high evaporation rate relative to precipitation, rainfall. And so these tend to occur in hot, dry environments, but they don't have to be hot, just as long as the evaporation is high. Now, from the plant perspective, this is something which I specialize in. Plants, as you appreciate, as you travel around the world, are very specific to certain conditions, mostly climate. So if you go, for example, to California or the Mediterranean or to Chile, the vegetation there looks very similar, even though the species which are growing are quite different. Similarly, if you go to the rainforests in Southeast Asia or the rainforests in Africa or the rainforests in South America, a rainforest looks very similar, but again, the species may not be the same. So climate constrains the architecture of plants in very stable ways, largely because the architecture is a function of the laws of physics, fluid transport, evaporation, gas diffusion, these sorts of things. And these laws don't change with time. So a plant's architecture ends up by being an engineering solution to a particular set of environmental constraints. And what we can do is, when we find fossil plants, we can decode the architecture in terms of climate. So one technique that I've been developing, along with a number of colleagues, is to look at the architecture of leaves. Leaves are exposed to the atmosphere, they process the atmosphere through photosynthesis and the like. And so the shape and size and characteristics of a leaf tend to be very closely related to the climate to which that leaf is exposed. And we can code leaves mathematically, numerically, and put them into a program that we have. And so when we find fossil leaves, we can read out things like temperature, mean annual temperature, to within 1 or 2 degrees of uncertainty. Warm month mean, cold month mean, precipitation during the growing season, the length of the growing season, humidity, and a very special characteristic called enthalpy, which we can use for determining paleo-altitude, ancient altitudes. And using this technique, we've been able to determine what the temperatures were like in the Arctic when these forests were growing. And so we can build up a picture not only of the vegetation, the plant dynamics, but also very precisely, quantitatively, the climate under which those forests were growing.
Well, you know, even the most educated among us were not taught much about Earth's history. I mean, so much is just being discovered now. Do you see the schools trying to play catch-up to teach us more about the planet's past climate?
Well, I hope so, because it's absolutely essential that everyone understands the complexity of the Earth system. There are no simple solutions to managing climate change. And people have to, as it were, appreciate the glorious complexity of the world in which we live. Now, in the past, in schools, people have tended to teach biology, chemistry, physics as quite separate subjects. But in Earth system science, it brings all of those subjects together, and you can see the relationship one to the other. Now, of course, in the school children today are going to be those that have to manage climate change much more than we do. I say we do because, you know, I'm quite a mature individual, shall we call it that. And I'm not going to be around to actually see the worst of climate change as it appears to be unfolding at the moment, particularly if we don't get a grip on carbon emissions into the atmosphere. And the reason why I'm particularly concerned is that when we look at deep time, when we look at these ancient environments and ancient climates, what it seems to suggest to me is that the future world, of a world of global warming, largely due to human activities, is actually going to be a world in which we see much greater change than is suggested by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And I'm quite happy to explain why I think that, if you wish me to.
Well, yes, I would like to know about that. I think everyone's trying to gauge the IPCC's predictions, and we have had other scientists saying, well, that's not enough, and it's happening faster than that. So, yes, please give us a few tips on that.
Okay. Well, the IPCC is a terrific organization, and I don't wish to be overly critical of it. It managed to bring together consensus amongst thousands of climate scientists, despite everyone having their own particular area of expertise. So it's a fantastic achievement. However, because the IPCC report has to be effectively agreed to by a large number of world governments, the IPCC has to provide information which is, one, quantified, and, two, has quantified uncertainties. That is to say, we have to be able to predict what the changes in the future are likely to be and what our level of confidence in those changes are. Now, some processes which are happening at the moment, we don't know enough about in order to quantify or quantify the uncertainties. And one example of this is the rate of mass loss of ice from Greenland, for example. In the last 5 years, that's accelerated enormously. The IPCC doesn't really understand, or the scientists in IPCC don't really understand those processes, and therefore the IPCC fourth assessment, which came out in January, explicitly says that it has ignored that. So any estimate of sea level rise is likely to be a very conservative one. But my particular area is a different concern. Now, when we reconstruct paleoclimate using a variety of techniques, and the leaf technique I've just explained is but one of a whole array of techniques, we tend to find that the conditions that we envisage happening in the past, whether it be in the greenhouse world of 100 million years ago or 50 million years ago or even 150 million years ago, when we reconstruct those and we ask the climate modelers to apply the climate models which are used in the IPCC to make forward forecasts, to try and retrodict or look back at these ancient times, we find that despite 30 years of model development, the modelers are unable to do that. So the biggest disparities, the biggest difference between the model results and the observations in the geological record tend to be in precisely those areas where we're seeing the greatest change at the moment, and that is in continental interiors and at high latitudes. And we've recently done some work in Russia, in Siberia, where we have looked at fossil leaves that are around about 80 million years old, and we have determined what the climate was like based on fossil leaves, on the overall fossil assemblage. Basically, we're looking at a vegetation that's rather similar to that which you would find in Florida today, a warm, temperate forest, very diverse. There's over 170 spore and pollen taxa there, which is an incredibly biodiverse area. And clay minerals, for example, they all suggest a warm, wet environment. And when we look at the leaves and numerically decode them, we're looking at a mean annual temperature of around about 13 degrees Celsius, with a cold month mean just above freezing, around about 5 degrees Celsius. Now, when we ask the models to try and reproduce that, what we find is that the models are telling us that the cold month mean ought to have been minus 20. So that is of concern, because no matter where we do these kinds of comparisons, the models are always very conservative. The models are all, and it doesn't matter which model you use, the models used for climate predictions are all based in weather forecasting. So the models are tuned to give you a very good representation of the here and now. Yet when we look at the models from the point of view of trying to predict the future, we're obviously asking the models to do something which is very different to the here and now. Similarly, when we ask the models to look back in time to a different set of circumstances, the models only know the present. And so they tend to give estimates of climate which are very strongly biased towards the present. And it doesn't matter what we do to the models. We can change the paleogeography, the positions of the continents. We can change the composition of the atmosphere. We can do a large number of experiments with these models. But no matter what you do to them, you still cannot get the models to reproduce those conditions which we see in the rock record. Now, if we go the other way into the future, what this means is the models are underestimating the degree of possible future change because the models are anchored in the present. Do you see where I'm
I do see that, and that's a serious problem. Well, we're talking with Professor Robert A. Spicer, who works with CEPSAR and the Warm Earth Environmental Systems Research Group based in the UK. Professor Spicer, listening to expert scientists, I've heard several discussions about rapid climate change in as little as a decade, perhaps, but most of these were abrupt cooling. Were there rapid warming events, as we may be experiencing now?
Yes, there have been a number of very rapid warming events, and I'll tell you about one which we've been working on here at the Open University. And that is going back to the early part of the Jurassic. Most people are familiar with the Jurassic Park scenario. And for many years, we thought the Jurassic was quite a stable climate. But there is evidence now to suggest that there were very rapid warmings. So if we go back to around about 180 million years ago, I think I've got that number right, I may be wrong, but about that time, and look at the mud rocks that we have in Yorkshire, in northern England, and take very, very detailed, closely spaced samples of carbon isotopes through many meters of sediment. What we find is that there are some very rapid changes in the carbon isotopes, which are indicative of large amounts of methane being released into the atmosphere. Now, these appear to be periodic. They are paced on timescales of about several hundred thousand years. In fact, we believe that the methane release is due to slight warmings that occur due to changes in the orbit of the Earth. This is all very understandable. We know that the Earth's orbit changes with time. This is what paced the waxing and waning of the ice sheets during the what we call the last ice age. Same things were going on back in the Jurassic, but instead of leading to waxing and waning of ice sheets, what was happening was that methane periodically was being released from the deep ocean. And I should perhaps explain here that methane can be stored at temperature, at low temperatures and depth in the ocean as a thing called a clathrate, which is kind of an ice that holds methane. And it is stable on the continental slopes at certain pressures and temperatures. But if you increase the temperature, for example, then that methane can be released into the atmosphere. When it's released into the atmosphere, it not only has an immediate, very strong greenhouse effect, but over time it oxidizes the carbon dioxide, and that remains in the atmosphere for hundreds of thousands of years, again causing a warming. Now, back in the Jurassic, we think that the methane releases back then gave rise to a global mean surface temperature rise of between 5 and 8 degrees Celsius, and it took over 100,000 years each time for the Earth's system to reabsorb what was then carbon dioxide back into the Earth and cool the planet down again. So it gives us not only an indication of extremely rapid warming events, but also it tells us how long it takes the natural system to readjust and bring temperatures back down to what they were before the event occurred. And if you're talking about timescales of 100,000 years to do that with a world clothed in forests, unlike agricultural surfaces today, which are not as effective at sequestering carbon dioxide, it gives us something to think about in terms of how long it will take for the world to adjust to the assault of carbon dioxide that we're putting into the atmosphere at the moment. And if you look back at these methane releases in the past, the kind of assaults on the atmosphere that they caused are somewhat similar to the ones which we are doing, which we human beings are responsible for at the moment. So climate change is something we're going to have to live with for a very, very long time.
You know, this leads me back to our discussion about the IPCC. I wanted to ask, given the unexpected mass of ice that disappeared from the Arctic Sea last summer, is it possible that major climatic events will develop more rapidly than our patient scientific methods can really digest or understand them? Is the scientific method going to be enough?
That's a very interesting question, and this was brought into sharp focus recently. A colleague in New Zealand told me of a dialogue that went on during the Australian elections, where the politicians were being challenged on what their response was to the droughts followed by flooding events in Australia, and asked whether or not this was a function of global warming. And the politician's response was, we don't know, but if it was, we can't be held responsible because the scientists didn't tell us clearly enough that this was likely to be one of the consequences. Now, of course, I would dispute that. The information on what you do if you double atmospheric carbon dioxide has been out in the scientific literature and the public domain since the late 1800s. Arrhenius did the calculations, which suggested that there would be a 4 degrees Celsius increase in global mean surface temperature if you doubled atmospheric CO2, and that sort of level of increase is precisely that which even our most sophisticated climate models are suggesting today. But the interesting thing there is that if the IPCC is regarded as being very conservative, which for reasons I explained earlier, I think it is, and if climate change turns out to be a lot more dramatic than the IPCC is suggesting it is, there is a danger that in future, either politicians or the public at large will turn around and say, the scientists did not do their job. They did not tell us what the likelihood of these dramatic changes were. And that, I think, is a potential problem. Now, the scientific method, yes, it does require an awful lot of careful observations, whether it be in the rocks of the past or the atmosphere of today, oceans of today. Yes, it does take a while. But there are sufficient voices out there saying, just a minute, we already know that the Earth can react really quite quickly and really quite strongly to the kind of, as I said earlier, assaults on the Earth system that human beings are responsible for. And I would say that, yes, the IPCC is the most benign view of the future, but if we are going to effectively plan adaptation and mitigation strategies, then I think we have to assume that it's likely to be a lot worse than that.
For self-informing amateurs like myself, what resources would you recommend to find out more about this developing knowledge of Earth's climate history?
Well, there are a variety of books out there. One of the best ones that I've seen is The Rough Guide to Climate Change. In fact, I've got it on my desk in front of me. That has been recently updated, and it gives you most of what you need to know, including a little bit of deep time. But we are publishing papers, scientific papers, all the time, and they are getting into the public domain. The Siberian work I've just explained or told you about will be published very shortly, and I'm hoping that there will be some attention paid to that, because, as I said, despite 30 years of model development, we still don't really understand why the models can't reproduce these climates of the past. It's a constantly developing field. I would refer people to things like the journals like The New Scientist, which is written in such a way that people can readily access it, even or access the science, even though they don't necessarily have the in-depth knowledge. I think that's probably most of what I can recommend at this point in time.
Well, we've barely scratched the surface, I know. Is there something else you would really like our listeners to know?
I think be patient. We're in it for the long haul. One of my worries is that public interest and media interest and political interest has a reputation for being somewhat short-lived. And yet, we are going to have to deal with the processes and consequences of climate change for many, many, many decades. And people will inevitably see gradual change in their lifestyle. Let me put this in context for you. The New Economics Foundation in the UK recently published a report where it tried to assess and the methodology, I should point out, is constantly under revision, but tried to assess the carrying capacity of different standards of living. So, for example, if everybody in the world had a standard of living such as we have in the United Kingdom, we would require 3.1 planets, and those planets would have to be biologically productive over all land surfaces, which, of course, they are not. That, I think, gives you some indication of the level of lifestyle adjustment that will inevitably be taking place over the coming decades. As far as Canada is concerned, Canada is likely to be one country which effectively benefits from global warming, in as much as a lot more of Canada's land surface will become biologically productive, whether it be agriculture or forestry or whatever. You'll certainly be able to grow trees much, much higher latitudes, but they may not be quite the same trees as we have at the moment. If you go back to the Cretaceous, most of those polar forests were deciduous, so even the conifers were losing their leaves during the dark winters. We are going to see some fairly dramatic changes. The thing that worries me most is that things like sea level rise will impact on around about 90% of the world's population, simply because most people live at or near sea level. We are going to see massive changes in resource availability, whether it be water or food, for example. Resources have always been a flashpoint as far as conflict is concerned. And when you change the availability of resources, there's even more incentive for conflict, if you like. We will see flooding of the world's major cities on a fairly regular basis as sea level rises due to expansion of the seas due to warming, plus melting of the polar ice. And that is going to impact hugely on economic, social, and political activity. So we're in for a rocky ride. If people are aware of that, forewarned of that, I think most people are in a position to take a more intelligent view of the future. But it's not going to be easy. And as you said earlier, our children, I think, need to understand these kinds of processes and changes. And if they understand them, then I think there is a chance they'll be more resilient to them.
We've been talking with Dr. Robert Spicer, a professor at the Open University in Britain. Professor Spicer, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
This is EcoShock Radio. All environment, all the time. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.